Classic Business Tax.
Well, I don't think the issue of tax has ever seen so much interest as during this Nugent inquiry, but we're going to take a step back all of that for a moment and rogue units and have a look at some important developments in the tax world outside of commissions. The latest on the venture capital company amendments and the latest concessions concerning the mineral royalty calculations concerning transport and insurance, particularly in the mining sector. I've got Mansoor Parker, Executive Tax at ENS Africa on the line. Evening, Mansoor.
Hello, Michael.
And Christel van Rensburg, a Tax Director also at ENS Africa. Welcome, Christel.
Good evening, Michael.
Mansoor, kick us off on the VCC amendments and perhaps just contextualize for listeners, firstly, how these Section 12J incentives were designed to work to provide a tax incentive for investors to de-risk what would otherwise be a very high-risk investment and accordingly create a platform to unlock investments for SMEs and create growth and jobs and value.
Sure. Michael, the venture capital company regime was introduced into the Income Tax Act in about 2009. And what it does is it provides a tax incentive for investors who invest indirectly into a target company through a venture capital company. And by doing that investment through a venture capital company, that investor obtains an upfront 100% tax deduction on the amount of the investment into the VCC. And the amount of the deduction is determined by the tax rate of the particular investor. So if the investor is an individual, is in the marginal, is in the top tax-paying bracket of 45%, that individual will get a tax refund of 45% of the amount contributed to the VCC. What that means is, if I were to put in 100,000 Rand into a VCC, I would receive a tax refund of 45,000 Rand in respect to that 100,000 Rand contribution. So my risk capital is effectively reduced from 100,000 Rand to 55,000 Rand. So that VCC, provided it returns to 55,000 Rand to me, I would not have made a loss. And obviously, if it returns an amount to me, it's in excess of 55, I start making a gain. So I think it's really put investors into a very a good position. And by routing these investments through the VCC, the investor benefits from the fund management capabilities of that fund. They will source the deal, they'll have the deal room set up, they'll do the due diligence, they will look for interesting prospects. The investor won't have to do so.
And the tax incentive was actually passed as long ago as 2009. However, it wasn't until recently when there were some minor tweaks and amendments and it rendered it far more workable into what you've just described. And as a result of that tweak, we saw most of the capital raised in the venture capital space happening in the last 2 years. Then Treasury came along this year, a couple of months ago, and said it was going to review the incentive because it was worried about abuse. What sort of abuse was taking place?
I think to understand the nature of the abuse that concerned Treasury, it's important to look at the development of venture capital companies. There were essentially two types that I developed, a so-called pooled fund and a so-called targeted fund. I use the description so-called because those terms are not referred to in 12J or anywhere in the Income Tax Act. But the pooled fund worked on the basis where investors would put their cash into the fund, the fund manager would accept that cash, look for qualifying companies to invest in, and report back to those investors on an annual basis or on the nature of investments that the VCC has made. The investors therefore seemed a fairly passive role. Then you have the targeted funds, which are more the specialist acquisition funds. These were funds that attracted more active type investors, your typical angel type investors who are really spotted an opportunity. They'd seen a company they'd like to invest in, and they wanted to channel those investments through the venture capital companies into that underlying company. So apart from providing funds, they'd also want to provide the expertise, the feedback, the advice, and the contacts to the underlying entity. And so we had this two set of streams developing, the pooled fund and the targeted fund. The targeted fund became useful for companies who are looking to do supply development for BE purposes in the supply chain. So they want to put cash into a VCC, but be certain that that cash would be used to subscribe for shares in a particular company. Generally, your pool funds are larger, but they take longer to deploy the cash because they've got to do more extensive due diligence. Mm. The targeted funds are a smaller proportion, but the cash tends to flow through quite quickly because they've already identified the underlying investment. Now, the problem that they usually saw occurred with some of the targeted funds where they felt that the investor, the corporate investor, and the underlying company, there's too much trading happening between those two entities. And they thought that that could lead to some abuse, particularly where companies, instead of creating new business lines, they simply fragment the existing divisions and they shove a division into a qualifying company and then subscribe for shares in a qualifying company through the VCC. And then they start trading with a qualifying company. And Treasury thought that that excessive trading between the corporate investor and the qualifying company is something which they wanted to halt.
That said, though, if you look at the approach that was taken by Treasury, it didn't really provide too much indication as to which kinds of schemes are regarded as abusive. If you look at the proposed amendments, they're going to apply to almost all VC structures. So it's a bit of a sledgehammer to kill a fly approach here. What is the current status with regards to the interactions you've had with Treasury?
And there's been a few meetings between the industry and Treasury regarding the proposed amendments. And I would agree, the approach was sort of taken the bazooka to swat a fly. And that approach has been tempered following the meetings. For instance, Treasury initially proposed that multiple share classes should be prohibited. But during those discussions, it became clear that many of the funds, the pooled funds and the target funds, would have multiple share classes for legitimate reasons. For instance, companies would issue different share classes for each round of capital raising. So a VCC which does a capital raise in 2016 would issue a 2016 VCC share. Those investors who subscribed to shares in 2017 would subscribe to 2017 VCC share. There were different classes of shares, but for purely sensible reasons. So Treasury has retreated from that position of saying that there be no share classes, no multiple share classes. What they've said now is that there will be share classes, multiples, provided that there is a spread of ownership in each share class. They do not want a single investor holding the shares in a particular share class. So that's been a very worthwhile accommodation on their side. With regard to the trading between the investor and the underlying company, Treasury's initial position was that about 85 to 90% of the income of a qualifying company should be derived from companies other than the investor. They've since reduced that percentage to 50% and said that qualifying companies would have a few years to become compliant with that number, would have up to 3 years to be compliant with that number. Because they recognize that initially companies may start off, they might have a few key contracts with big suppliers as they're building their business. Mm-hmm. And due to an economic downturn, a big corporate customer who can no longer provide them with business falling by the wayside, they may inadvertently exceed that percentage. So we saw the initial round of amendments has been tempered down quite significantly during the course of the interactions between the VCC industry and SARS and Treasury.
Well, Mansour, I'm really glad that some common sense has prevailed. It would take a very brave government to dissuade investment in this economic environment. Please wait there, Christel. I'll get to you after we are done with our 6 p.m. news wrap. Pusuletso Peterson is standing by.
In Gauteng and the Western Cape, this is Classic Business.
Welcome back to the show. It's just gone 4 minutes past six, and I've got Christel van Rensburg, Director of Tax at ENS Africa, who's been waiting patiently on the line, Christel, to talk about mining royalty calculations. And it all has to do with the proposed amendment to Section 6(3) of the Mineral Petroleum Resources Royalty Act, better known as the Royalty Act. What is that proposed amendment all about?
Okay, so Michael, Section 6 of the Royalty Act determines the gross sales, and gross sales is the tax base on which the mineral royalty is calculated. So the higher the gross sales, the higher the royalty. That's the effect.
Mm.
And Section 63B specifically states that gross sales are determined without regard to any expenditure incurred in respect of transport, insurance, and handling. So any expenditure incurred to transport or handle the mineral should be excluded from gross sales. And the proposed change is to actually remove the words expenditure incurred and replace it with the words amount received or accrued.
What is the reason for that amendment?
Yeah, so on the face of it, doesn't appear like a lot, but the reason for that, based on the explanatory memorandum from National Treasury, is that their original policy intent was always to exclude transport, insurance, and handling from the gross sales. So to not include that in the tax base, because that would unintentionally make the royalty higher. Well, in 2009, they actually made a small change to this Section 63B, and they are of the view that recent disputes between SARS and taxpayers on the wording appears that the policy is not that clear in the wording how it was changed, although the policy never changed over the years. So they wanted to revert back to the original wording before the small change in 2009, which is these words of the actually received or accrued.
And why is there so much resistance to the proposed amendment now?
Well, we just went through a few disputes with SARS on this, and especially we went through to court for a high court declaratory order on the UMK case on the specific wording. And now the court has ruled and has explained what the wording means, and it's 100% in line with the policy that transport, insurance, and handling should not be included in gross sales. And to change the wording now will just create more uncertainty and, again, unpredictability. So we said, well, why change things if it's not broken? That type of concept.
Yeah, I mean, that is some common sense that is all too often lacking when we're dealing with regulation in South Africa. What was the outcome of the consultation between the mining companies and Treasury and SARS?
So there were extensive consultation. Last week was the last of the consultation held between National Treasury, SARS, and mining industry. Based on that engagement, it looks like the proposed amendment, as I explained earlier, will not go through in the current form. The wording will be changed in line with the UMK judgment, which is 100% in line with the policy to, if you've incurred the expenditure relating to transport, insurance, and handling, it should not be included in gross sales, and i.e. not in the tax base. And I think if this is going to go through, and we will just have to wait and see what the final legislation looks like, but then that will welcomed, and I think it will show that the mining industry has been listened to in this regard.
Yeah.
And I think it will give a lot of certainty and predictability.
And that's exactly what the current environment is asking from the president to attract and increase FDI into the mining sector. So two rays of light in the tax world. Thank you very much, Christel van Rensburg, Tax Director at ENS Africa. Yeah.